You've probably heard of sheltered workshops over the years, places where people with intellectual and developmental disabilities can work at kind of regular jobs. Over time, the question became who was being sheltered and from what, because the people who work in those workshops are segregated from the working public, both in place and in job benefits. The workers' pay is often a fraction of what people earn in regular workplaces. For these and other reasons, a class action suit took the state of Oregon to court, and the suing led to a settlement that will change the system. Two guests join us. Bob Joondeff is the executive director at Disability Rights Oregon. Bob, thank you for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
And Emily Wild is with us as well. She's the fairly recently installed CEO at Living Opportunities based in Medford. Emily, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bob, I'm pretty clear on what your organization is about. The name is pretty much a dead giveaway, but give us an idea of how hard it is to obtain rights for people with disabilities in Oregon.
Well, sometimes we have systems that have been funded for a long time that haven't changed quite a bit and don't focus on individual rights. They focus more on the ease of providing services for folks with disabilities. And so in this case, we had a system in which kids in school were funneled into sheltered workshops, which were segregated settings and still are. And there really weren't very much in the way of alternatives, even though Oregon had been a pioneer in creating integrated employment opportunities, that is, working in a grocery store or a factory or something of that sort with non-disabled people way back in the 90s. We kind of slipped back into just funneling people into these workshops where they earned sub-minimum wage and really didn't have any opportunity to get out.
Emily Wild, when we talk about integrated employment, that's a lot of what Living Opportunities is all about, isn't it?
It is. Living Opportunities back in the 90s actually had one of these sheltered workshops, and long before a settlement or before it was kind of the in thing to do, the leadership of the organization decided that that's really did not follow the mission and closed that sheltered workshop and focused from that point on really developing community jobs for people who experience disability, and we are able to kind of see the fruits of that today with over 100 individuals in Jackson County working in over 80 businesses.
What kinds of jobs? I remember for years Living Opportunities held the contract with the city of Medford to keep the lawns maintained along Biddle Road and some other areas in town. Is that still a case?
Yeah, you know, we have jobs all from kind of in every spectrum. We have individuals that work at banks. We have individuals working at SOU and local restaurants. We have, you know, just like all the rest of us have dreams and aspirations and skills that really lead us down one avenue or another. I think we've done a really good job of developing systems that really look at where are people's skills, where is the right job match, and being able to match people accordingly.
Now, Bob, you mentioned that there's obviously been a shift over time, but then a bit of backsliding that led to people ending up in sheltered workshops again. So did sheltered workshop populations drop and then rise again?
What happened in Oregon really is that we had a large state institution that was closed during the late 90s, and during that time, a lot of focus of the state went into moving people out of that big institution. And what sheltered workshops were and are really kind of mini institutions, little day institutions, if you will, where people can live at home but go in a setting where they're overseen by non-disabled people all day. So what this did was it meant that those folks didn't have a choice. They didn't have a choice to seek employment in the community or outside the community. And so, yeah, we saw a lessening of the use of those institutional settings and then a large increase when we moved into the years after 2000.
So this led to the lawsuit Lane versus Brown. It was originally Lane versus Kitzhaber. So it's a lawsuit versus the Oregon governor in either case. And Lane is not Lane County. Who is Paula Lane, and what were the conditions that led to this lawsuit?
Well, Paula Lane is a woman with an intellectual and developmental disability who wanted to work in the community, wanted to receive the training and support she needed to have a regular job, and she just wasn't getting the services and assistance that she needed to do that. So she was stuck in a workshop where she was earning just pennies an hour for what she was doing. So she came to us and said, you know, I don't like this. I want something better. I want to have a choice in terms of what types of services that I receive. And that's what started everything.
And so the lawsuit was a federal suit, wasn't it?
Yeah, we filed in federal court on behalf of seven individual plaintiffs and an organization, United Cerebral Palsy, and we filed in federal court. That was back in 2012, and that was after lengthy negotiations with the state that really didn't get us anywhere. And it took another three, almost 4 years, before we were able to agree on some terms and entered into a settlement, which the court now has approved.
All right, so it didn't end up going to trial. It got settled out of court, in essence.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Which is, I imagine, a good development for certainly for budgets to pay lawyers and things like that.
Well, you know, it is very positive, because what happened was that after some initial legal skirmishes, Oregon understood that it did have an obligation to offer people choice, and it started to implement changes in policy to do that. And so over those years, we recognized that the state was actually getting some traction and making some progress, and we wanted them to continue. And so our ultimate agreement was that the state continue what it's doing, but that there be some accountability so that they don't change their mind somewhere down the road.
We're talking about the Lane versus Brown class action lawsuit against the state of Oregon to provide better working conditions and pay for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities across the state of Oregon. Bob Junedeff is with Disability Rights Oregon. Emily Wild is with Living Opportunities. And you can join our discussion on the exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Emily, if you could give us an idea of the work it takes just to convince employers potentially at first that you can bring people with intellectual and developmental disabilities out of these sheltered workshops and into real workplaces that the rest of us work in.
I think that the best way to, for lack of a better term, convince somebody is really their peers. So businesses and business owners being able to talk to other businesses about what this looks like. You know, this isn't a matter of going in and looking at jobs that are currently posted and trying to find somebody and plug them into that job that already exists. Our success has really been in job carving. So coming into a business, seeing where the needs are, and then finding somebody who we've done extensive background to really learn skills who is a perfect match. And that doesn't mean that when somebody comes into our services, they're assigned a number, and then when your number is up, you automatically get the next job. You know, we have a fantastic job developer, Bailey Lavoie, who's out there meeting with businesses, connecting with them, and having fantastic success in that, being able to kind of do those perfect matches. And having a job coach that comes in, we have staff that come in and learn the job. That's one of the very first things, learn what has to be done. And then being able to teach that job. And then depending on the individual, some people have that job coach who stays with them for the duration of the time that they're there. We have other people who eventually, co-workers and other people who work at that business say, you know, the supports that are needed are things that we can absolutely provide. And we're able to fade from that kind of day-to-day situation. However, the minute a job changes or something changes within the workplace, we come right back and are able to support people. And we've really seen people able to maintain jobs for a long time because of that, kind of the way we do it, and really happy business owners who feel like this is truly a win-win, and it changes our organization and it changes our business. The minute you have diversity that really reflects what our community is, I think it forever changes the way we view people, and misconceptions can kind of go out the door.
Are the workers brought in through Living Opportunities, for example, or any other similar organization, are they on parity with the other workers? I mean, are they getting the same levels of pay and all that sort of thing?
So they're across the state. That is not always the case. But Living Opportunities several years ago took a stance that we were only going to be developing jobs at minimum wage or higher. And our reality has been that most business owners who are not connected to the developmental disability world don't even know that sub-minimum wage is a choice. They don't have that choice for other people that they employ. And so the idea that I could pay someone 50 cents an hour or $1.50 an hour would seem ludicrous to them. So when we talk about the job, we talk about what, you know, we would pay and equitable pay and why that's important, and it's really well received.
Let's take a call. We have Paul in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about employment for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities with Bob Joondeff and Emily Wild. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. You know, I'm very concerned about the spectrum of abilities that these people have. I don't like the word disabilities. I used to coach Special Olympics, and all of these people are able. It's just a question of where they stand in the spectrum of abilities. Does this settlement provide allowances for those people who are at the lower spectrum of ability and still create an environment where they can have a valuable experience? Yes, we have come a long ways. When I was a kid going to Hoover Elementary School, the developmentally disabled children were kept in the boiler room. You know, it was horrible, and wow, they'd come out and play with us during the breaks. So I'm very concerned about that, and I am also concerned because, again, of this spectrum of abilities, that some component of the sheltered workshop system will still exist that allows for people at that spectrum of the ability scale. All right. I'll take my answer to take the comments off the air.
Great. Thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it. So Bob, let's that cuts right to the major question is, will sheltered workshops continue to exist in any form?
Well, I think Paul's is a great question, and you know, the key to all of this is individualized planning and services. In other words, the problem with sheltered workshops is that it was kind of one size fits all, and everybody had to go there. What we want is for each individual to be assessed to ascertain both their skills, their abilities, and their desires, and then to work on providing them with the services they need in order to have the best opportunity to have some achievement in their life, to experience that part of life that we all value. And so there may be people who need to be in a more segregated setting, but it should not be unnecessarily segregated. And that's what we're asking for, is that to the extent that people can be successfully integrated into a broader society with non-disabled people, that they have an opportunity to do that. And that's what the suit asks for.
And I noticed that we're talking about by June 30th of next year, Oregon reducing the number of individuals in sheltered workshops with intellectual developmental disabilities by about a quarter, it looks like, and decrease the time that they spend in sheltered workshops by about a third.
Yes, and what we're asking for, Jeff, is that... as we develop a new system and put more resources into integrated employment opportunities, that there will be, in essence, a competition between those types of more integrated services and the old-fashioned services. And what we believe that you will see is that as more people realize their opportunities, as more families recognize the value of integrated employment, that they'll make that choice and that there'll be a decreased reliance upon these more segregated settings.
Emily Wild, does anybody track an unemployment rate for people who are capable of working with intellectual and developmental disabilities?
Well, I think without organizational support to find jobs, you know, Living Opportunities is somewhat of, we're in the smaller percentage across the state. Organizations like ours are moving in this direction, but we have been just doing this longer. So we're working with other entities, but the reality is the unemployment rate is very high for people who experience disability, and we're working to change that.
Bob, does anything change about the pay scales for people with intellectual developmental disabilities through this settlement?
Well, for people who are working in the community, they are entitled to at least minimum pay, minimum wage pay, and to be treated as an equivalent employee. These sub-minimum wage situations are specific to sheltered work environments or what are called enclave-type work where people are segregated. So as you see people increasingly move into competitive employment, you'll see less and less of the sub-minimum wage. I'll add that on a national level, and in Oregon, there is a debate about whether sub-minimum wage should continue at all. The argument being that minimum wage means exactly that, minimum wage, that if a person is going to put their full effort into a job, that they should be reimbursed at least at a designated level. So that debate continues. But for right now, nonprofits that provide sheltered work opportunities can continue to pay subminimum wage.
All right. So the settlement lays out several years of work still ahead to be able to change the system. And as you heard, not change it completely, but certainly make a big dent in what's going on now. We're talking about employment for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Our guests have been Bob Joondeff, the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and Emily Wild, the CEO at Living Opportunities. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much.